Hey everyone, this is Beth.
And I'm Jeff.
And this is your Enneagram Coach, the podcast. And it's our mission to help you and others to see themselves with astonishing clarity so that we can all break free from self-condemnation, fear, and shame by knowing and experiencing the unconditional love, forgiveness, and freedom in Christ. Now keep in mind, we are also on YouTube. So if you would love to see our beautiful faces, head over to our YouTube channel at Your Enneagram Coach. We'd love for you to check us out there.
I don't think I've ever made an appeal to people to go to YouTube to see my beautiful face.
Well, they can now.
We do have this one script. Like sometimes we refer to people being sixes as their sixiness.
Yes.
And one time I did say, when I think about my sexiness,
yes.
That was pretty audacious.
That was pretty, I couldn't stop laughing.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us. So this is going to be the first in a series of episodes where we're going to be talking about productivity, but from an Enneagram perspective. And on this particular episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking with John Acuff about his recent release, Soundtracks, The Surprising Solution to Overthinking. Now, before you start thinking that overthinking is only assigned to a type or two, particularly sixes, let me just help you understand. It applies to everyone. So let me begin with just a summary from the book. And this is fantastic. Overthinking isn't a personality trait. It's the sneakiest form of fear. Mm. It steals time, creativity, and goals. It's the most expensive, least productive thing companies invest in without even knowing it. And it's an epidemic. So in this book, John offers a proven plan to change overthinking from a super problem into a superpower. Mm. And if you want to tap into the surprising power of overthinking and give your dreams more time and creativity, learn how to DJ the soundtracks that define you. If you can worry, you can wonder. If you can doubt, you can dominate. If you can spin, you can soar. Jeff's not anything that I'm about to describe.
Speaking yourself in the third person.
I just take on other people's accomplishments. Yeah, I feel better.
What number is that? That is so eight. That's a classic eight move.
Yeah, well, and three.
Well, John, let's be honest. I mean, you did say borrow from other people. I can just borrow your accomplishment. I'm John Acuff.
Yes, yes.
I can write this book today. I can. So John is a New York Times bestselling author of 7 books and an Inc. magazine top 100 leadership speaker. He lives outside of Nashville, Tennessee with his wife and 2 daughters. John, so grateful and welcome to the podcast. My heart's actually really happy to be with you because you've actually been a voice for me over the past several years in our entrepreneurial journey. So we are so thrilled to be talking with you today.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to it. We connected, I think, 2 or 3 years ago the first time via my brother. We've got a million mutual friends. So yeah, it's been really fun to have a front row seat watching you guys build what you build and help so many people. So I can't wait to talk today.
Yeah. And I think we used to live just a hop and a skip from him, right?
That's right. A few neighborhoods over.
But now we're about 20 minutes. But
yep.
But 20 minutes in Nashville is a long way. In Atlanta, people will be like, I have a pretty good commute. It's only 50 minutes each way.
Right. That's right.
In Nashville, they're like, oh, it was 11 minutes. It was so hard.
That is
like,
so true.
We have a different scale of driving. So you guys live a long way away.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And so our hope today is to focus our time on the main theme of the book, our personal soundtracks and how we can turn them from unhealthy to healthy patterns. But as we do here, like we do everything else at Your Enneagram Coach, we're going to apply some of these principles that John has identified to each of the Enneagram types. And so if it's okay for me to ask, and it's not too uncomfortable for you, John, what's your Enneagram number?
So I'm going to give you an either or because I've had people call me both.
Okay.
I identify like test-wise as a 7. But then I feel like most of my life is 3. So okay. I had our mutual friend, Dave Barnes. We were talking one day and he said, you're either a 3 or you're the most goal-driven 7 I've ever met in my entire life. And so I would say I'm one of those 2. A lot of times people go, you're 7, you're fun, you're spontaneous, you know, you like to, you know, laugh a lot. But like, I'm very achievement-based. I'm very achievement-oriented. So for me, it's either one of those 2. But every test I've ever taken has leaned heavily on 7.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, we could go there.
Is there a subtype of 7 that relates with 3?
Well, I mean, 3s and 7s actually have quite a bit in common. They're both go-getters. They're both forward thinking, wanting to accomplish. But the biggest thing is for a three, so this will be kind of, and you have to remember, we use all nine types to varying degrees. Sure. And especially if you get into what's called the tri-type, three and seven could be on your tri-type. The question is, which one is your main one? So the biggest difference between threes and sevens is if you aren't able to be successful in something or achieve a goal, for the three, that is like their core fear, to fail, to be incompetent, to not measure up, to not be admired by their accomplishment. Now, a seven, on the other hand, if they don't succeed at something, to them, they're just a new possibility. They're just able to spin it.
I don't feel that way at second. No, like the three. The three, like, no way, dude.
Yeah,
I would never be like, turn a frown upside down. That failure is just a new way to learn about myself. Like, no. Yeah.
The next time you talk to Dave, just even ask him that question. Like, hey, like, if you don't succeed at something or something falls through, like, do you just kind of like think of it as a new opportunity or spin it into a new?
Wasn't it a seven and eight where we were talking that failure is not even a word? It's not even a concept.
Yeah, it's not even a concept. It's just, it's a new opportunity.
No, I don't. I've never felt that 1 second of my entire 46 years. So,
because for the three, the core fear of the three is failure, is to not being successful, is to losing the admiration of others. And so it's all about these accomplishments. And so now the three they set their goals based on what they can do and what they can accomplish. So it's very measured. It's not like, you know what, I'm going to become like Michael Jordan and just go for it. Like, they'll do that if they know they're the kind of person that actually could accomplish that. So they're very measured on the goals they're going to achieve because their greatest fear is failing. Now, once they've set the goal, then they kind of backtrack with a list of all the things that need to happen to make sure that that actually occurs. Does that sound
accurate? Here's my 10-page document with my 2023 goals working on since early November. So yeah,
now,
three all day. Three
now,
all day.
All of those... Are any of those like out of reach, not possibilities? You probably could fail at them.
I think, I'm now going, because I feel like I've tried so many goals in my life, I no longer do the thing where I go, I read 5 books, next year, 50. I go, what's 10% more than 50? I'll shoot for 55. I'll be pleasantly surprised if I do 60, but I'm not doing the thing that people do where they hear
one Eminem
song.
It's this measured ability to continue to excel.
Yeah.
But not so lofty that you're going to reach that point where you're feeling like a failure and you have to like spin yourself out of control.
No. And it's going to be based on like setting myself up for success because I've seen, again, like coaching people in goals, I've seen 10,000 people go, I'm going to run an Ironman tomorrow. And I always go, well, have you ever done a 5K or a 10K or a K, like a single K?
Have you gotten off the couch?
Yeah, but like we have this, at least when it comes to goals and productivity and performance, this kind of like mentality of go hard or go home. Yeah. Or like we say garbage things online. Like sometimes you have to grow wings on the way down. You have to jump first. Like that's never how gravity works. Like gravity doesn't work that way. So I'm way more measured. So maybe three. I feel like I'm feeling very three.
Yeah. Cause and like I said, the sevens, their defensive mechanism is reframing and they're always in this positive oriented thinking. So again, if failure comes up, they're going to reframe that it's not a failure. But if seven is in your tri-type, which we can't get into it, but that would mean that it's a part of you that pops up often. What that means is that you would be a three that has goals and you're going to accomplish it and you have a list and you're going to, you know, fulfill these lists in a measured way. But the seven's going to bring a lot of affirmation and fun and probably spontaneity to that three part of your heart. So the three and the seven will just look a lot more positive, go-getter, fun, and obviously funny in the way that they go about it. Whereas if you had three and let's say five was in your tri-type, that's a whole different kind of three, right?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Moms, I am so excited to share with you a huge and wonderful opportunity that we have created for you this summer. It's our Enneagram for Moms cohorts. Yes, a group of moms of your same Enneagram type coming together for a safe place to connect, share, and hear and be validated Wouldn't that be amazing to be with other moms of your same Enneagram type who see the world through the same lens and truly understand you? It's going to be amazing. But here's the thing. There are only 25 spots per cohort. We have one in the daytime and one in the evening of your type to choose from. But you're going to want to sign up the day it opens. We open registration May 6th to May 13th. Now, these groups will kick off the week of June 10th, and they will go until the week of July 29th. That's 8 weeks together for 90 minutes, sharing, laughing, crying, being together in that safe, intimate place to connect with moms to develop deep, meaningful friendships. And there's so many other things that are going to come with the cohort. I hope that you will join us and learn more when you sign up on May 6th to May 13th at yourenneagramcoach.com/cohorts. I can't wait to see you there.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes complete sense. So three all day. That's what I'm believing.
So John, I mean, you've been here in Nashville, and at some point in time, someone told us that there are more Google searches about the Enneagram in Nashville than there is in any other city.
Yeah, I believe it.
It became that popular 2019. So you've been around the crazy of the Enneagram world and how people have used the Enneagram. I mean, what's been your experience of being in Nashville where the Enneagram is so popular?
Well, yeah, I think they search for it as much as they search for influencer hats. Those flat brim hats that like 90% of people think they can wear and only 10% can. Dude, the average head does not look good in that hat. Like hat salesmen are lying to so many people in this city.
Going, and they're making
a great hat. Yeah, you look like a character from Yellowstone. That's a good look. It's not a good look, dude. There's only like two men that can wear hats. It's Justin Timberlake and like Mr. Peanut. And so like... For me, I've seen so many people, where I laugh about Enneagram sometimes, and you and I have talked about this before, is I think some people use it as a quick chance to talk about themselves while still looking interested in you. So they go, what's your type? They don't care about your type. They just want you to go, what's your type? So they can go, I'm going to tell you the 72 things I learned about eight. And so like sometimes I think people use Enneagram as a chance to go, I'd like to talk about myself for the next hour under the guise of being curious if you're a two. But as soon as you say your number, I'm going to tell you like the deepest things ever. That's the first thing I think is funny. And then the second is when I'll say to somebody, well, where did it come from? And they'll go, oh, it's desert wisdom. It's ancient desert wisdom. And I'll go, oh, well, let me just accept that then. No year, no background. Just like if somebody said to you, here's some medicine. And you said, well, how is it developed? And you're like, it's from the desert. Don't ask questions. Like, stop being
stoned. Don't ask questions.
Don't be judgy. It's from a cave. Yeah. Like, Thomas Merton loved it. Like, and you just go, you're confusing me with your fuzziness.
You don't hear that about the Amazon, though. I mean, there's wisdom that comes from the desert. Maybe sometimes there's mountains, but
there's wet wisdom. There's less.
That's right. It's got to be very dry. You don't hear about the Amazon fathers. You hear about the desert fathers.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. There's less river wisdom. I think you're onto something. So maybe there needs to be a book like the Enneagram River. Like, put that together. Nobody's cornered that into.
No
like,
one's
that
cornered
word.
That.
No one's cornered.
Yeah. Our literary agents writing notes right now.
There's no marsh wisdom. Nobody's like, I got this from the marshes.
Oh,
like,
no, absolutely not.
Or the bayous.
Yeah, so the bayous. I don't know. I could see some wisdom coming from there.
Cajun wisdom.
Yeah, that would be really.
Gator-based. A lot of gator wisdom.
That would be fun. That would be super fun.
Well, hey, so let's dive into the topic for the day.
Sure.
And now, I love this. Now, I'm not sure how many people read dedications. But I saw the dedication to your book and just thought like, oh, I have heard that from my wife so often. But the dedication of this book is, John, I think you might be overthinking this, Jenny Acuff.
Yeah. She said that a million times. I mean,
What does that overthinking look like for you?
Okay, so a specific example would be somebody goes, hey, let's go to a new restaurant in the Gulch or WeHo or like super down uptown, Gulch Town. Like we're just making up areas of Nashville at this point by jamming words together. And you go, where is that? And they're like, it's Upper Germantown, Gulch Town. And you're like, I don't know what that means. But say somebody goes, let's go to a new restaurant. I immediately go, what's the parking like? Like, do they have, like, is it street parking? Is it valet? Is it one of those hipster restaurants where it can seat 100 and park 2? Like, would they have a tiny little park? Like, is it going to be $1,000? Like, what's the parking like? And somebody will say to me, wow, you're really overthinking the parking. You didn't ask a single question about the food, the chef, like what day we're going to go. You really went all in on parking.
So what is it about the parking that really gets you going?
For me, it's I have this vision in my head of I'm trying to parallel park and there's like 50 people in bandstands watching me fail at parallel parking. And so what I do to offset that is I'll park at the first spot I see and then walk like 2 miles. And my wife will point out spots that were closer as we get to the restaurant.
She's
like,
so funny.
Look at that spot. I park like it's the last spot that will ever exist. Or as if I've been to a restaurant once and there was no parking and we just had to go home. Like every restaurant I've gone to, I've been able to park and also eat. Like it's worked out.
Yes.
So that's a really small example.
But here's what's so funny about that is you could potentially also
Not about me. This is about John.
I know. We're wrapping it up with Enneagram. So you as a 6 could also worry about parking, but what would you be thinking about it? Would there even be a parking space?
Yeah, there's something about missing out on a better parking space for me.
Ah, okay.
So I'm trying to get as close as possible. But when we go to things downtown, I am very, like I have spot. I've already planned in advance. I know where I parked before, and so I've got a go-to spot that I can get to.
Right. So the reason why I'm bringing that up is just as a 6, you're thinking more strategically and planning.
Oh, sure.
He's thinking about failing and others
being
exposed.
Well, Beth, let's just walk the wheel on each type
parks.
But
I just think that's why it's so funny, especially him kind of like in my 3 or a 7. The 7 would have been like, yeah, let's go for it. And like, whatever,
Never. Like, I think I learned as a child, probably through trauma, that humor was a great way to present. And I just became a 7 as a performance art.
Yeah.
And now as I'm older and mature and successful enough to be who I am, that's just funny. But I'm like, oh, maybe I like to achieve. Like, maybe I like to accomplish.
Yeah.
But
yep.
Another example that your listeners can probably relate to of overthinking is if you've ever told yourself an elaborate story about why somebody didn't text you back. So you texted them, you waited an hour, 2 hours, they didn't respond, or worse, they sent the bubbles and pulled the bubbles back, or you reread a sent email so that you sent the email an hour ago, a day ago, a week ago, maybe you went to your sent email folder. There's nothing you can do. That thing is gone and you reread it. Third is if you've ever self-edited an idea before you even wrote it down. Before you even gave it 30 seconds of oxygen on a piece of paper or in your laptop, you said, somebody smarter has done that. That's not worthwhile. And I just think about all the business ideas for art, cures for diseases we've lost because somebody overthought before they captured it. So those are 3 easy examples.
Yeah.
Well, the metaphor of soundtracks, it immediately gravitated to me. I remember years ago hearing a friend, something had happened in her life and she was telling someone else about it. And he said, wow, you've put a lot of time in writing that script.
Mm. Yeah.
So where she had written, and this was probably, you know, the next episode in the new Netflix series, because it's the same beliefs, it's the same outcomes that we write in our heads. And it's a soundtrack. Now, as a type 6, I'm always thinking about something. I remember when we were looking at the house that we were in now, we got onto the highway and Beth said, hey, I'm just curious, what have you been thinking about since we got on the highway?
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of telling her as if she could handle it. And I told her, and you were upset.
I was so overwhelmed. I mean, like, we had only been on the highway maybe 2 miles. And, like, he gave me this monologue for, like, 5 minutes of, like, all the things, like, probably all the things I would have thought in, like, a whole day.
That's amazing.
So, John, I'm a 6. John, Beth's a 9. And that is just, I'm going down the road at a high speed. She's slowing down in her little Fiat,
but
that's been the dynamic for us. But it, I will say, you know, the idea of soundtracks and thinking that there is this ongoing narrative of beliefs, values, that of how we anticipate things are supposed to turn out for us that are actually getting in the way. So what led you to think about this, the concept of soundtracks as your kind of driving metaphor?
Well, I always look for things in my own life that I want to change, and then I see if other people want to change them too. So I'm an overthinker. Like the dedication was a joke, but it was also true. So the way I write books is I find something I'm deeply, passionately connected to, something I want to change. I see if other people need it. So me and this PhD, Mike Peasley, who's a professor in Nashville, asked 10,000 people if they struggle with overthinking. 99.5% of them said yes. So that's a huge audience and a huge need. And then I look for, can I fit in the marketplace? Mm-hmm. Is there a spot for me? So I looked at all these resources and realized so many of them were like, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop thinking. And one, that's impossible. Like, I love meditation, yoga, whatever. That's 10 minutes of your day. That's 30 minutes. What about the other 23 and a half hours? And number two, we were designed to think. It's a tremendous gift. Like, I always say every blue jay has built the same nest that every blue jay has built. There's never been a blue jay that was like, I'm going to do a townhouse with like steel instead. Yeah. I'm going to do a log cabin. But we as humans have this amazing gift to think. And so what if I could figure out some simple ways to make all this thought work for me, not against me? That's how I started to think about it. And then the metaphor soundtracks, I'm always captivated by the idea that the soundtrack is playing in the background and we often don't notice it, but it has the power to change the entire moment. And so that's how I think about thoughts. I think about, what did I add to that conversation? I added some thoughts to that, maybe before I even got there, that changed that conversation. I didn't know I had these soundtracks on repeat. And then probably living in a musical city, like we both have the benefit of living into, music's in the water. And so a soundtrack, a musical metaphor really stuck out to me as, well, I haven't seen somebody do this. I think it's really sticky. I consider my job to be a handle maker. I put handles on ideas so that people can take them into their lives. We have enough ideas. We don't have handles to carry them. That's why the Enneagram works so well. The Enneagram is an amazing set of handles. And so that's what soundtracks felt like me too, is it was a really easy handle.
That's great.
Well, I think about, so when we go to downtown Franklin, for a season, there was played the violin on the same corner in downtown Franklin. And when we would go to downtown Franklin, we'd roll down the windows, even if we were just driving through to our house.
And even if it was cold.
Even if it was cold. Why? Because it brought some kind of meaning to it. And so the power of soundtrack is such a powerful metaphor. I love this quote that you wrote. It said, if you listen to any thought long enough, it becomes part of your personal playlist. And I mean, even to consider the concept that we have a playlist, certain beliefs and narratives that come up repeatedly for our lives. And the one way that the Enneagram is helpful in that sense is that there's a certain level of predictability based upon Enneagram type. So, Bethy, why don't you walk us through, as you think about a soundtrack, what would be, just walk the wheel quickly. What would be a soundtrack for each type?
Yeah, but if I can just kind of back up, I just want to preface that, you know, that's why the Enneagram is so dynamic, because I can literally, like, even just you talking about parking, like, I could have guessed what the reason was, but I wanted to hear it from you. But I knew it had to do more with success, failure, image, those kinds of things, because that's the way the soundtracks work in a type three. And so, now, a lot of times what's unfortunate is that people, when they find out, let's say, their negative soundtracks, because there's positive soundtracks too, which I'm sure we'll get into, but when they hear about their negative soundtracks, what they usually do as a human is they start to condemn, put themselves down, feel guilty, and that just spirals it into more soundtracks that are negative, versus just seeing it as, you know what? Yeah, as a type nine, I have these soundtracks and they're going to probably be with me for the rest of my life, but it doesn't have to derail me. It doesn't have to get me off track. I can notice when they pop up and I can then make the choice if I'm going to believe it or if I'm going to bring in a better soundtrack that actually will help me to get, you know, where I want to go and live the life that I, you know, want to live in a healthier way. So I think that's what our goal is with using the Enneagram is to point out, yeah, I know some of these things that we say aren't fun and they kind of sting at first, but it's not intended to stay there. It's not intended to continue to hurt. It's so that you feel it like that rumble strip on the highway, that this is your alert system. Like when you start thinking in these patterns, you need to realize that that's a negative soundtrack. That's not true. And now you need to go find the truth soundtracks and bring those into your life. So I'll go through the nine types. And these are just portions of soundtracks, right? So when we think of a soundtrack like a movie, there's lots of music in a soundtrack, but these are just like snippets of the soundtrack. So, so for type one, they're going to be thinking, since I can't be wrong, bad, or make mistakes, I need to constantly focus on what needs to be fixed, perfected, and corrected. The type two soundtrack might be, since it's selfish of me to take care of my own needs and emotions, I will now focus solely and assist others on their needs and emotions. The type three might think, well, since failure or incompetency is not a possibility, I'm going to fixate on my to-do list to ensure that I accomplish and achieve all the goals that I've set for myself. The type four soundtrack might be something like, since I feel there is something missing or flawed within me, I must continue to dive within myself to understand myself fully and my authentic trueness so I can bring that to bear for others to see and understand. Now, the type fives, their soundtrack might sound like, since I fear my energy reserves and material resources will be completely depleted, and that I'm not going to have enough knowledge to be competent, I'm going to fixate on minimizing what I need and my interaction with others while also absorbing all the knowledge possible to feel capable and competent. Now, the type six might say in their mind, since my mind is constantly thinking, as we heard Jeff earlier, is constantly thinking of all the possible outcomes, I can't trust my own thoughts. Therefore, I must constantly find guidance and support from others that I trust, which is tricky because I have a difficulty trusting others, which keeps my mind in a constant state of apprehension and overthinking. Type seven, they might have the soundtrack of, since I don't trust that others can help me to come through with complete satisfaction and contentment, I'm going to have to fixate on forging my own path by constantly thinking of the next best thing and ensure that I will find joy and fulfillment that I desperately crave. And then type eight soundtrack might be, since people are not trustworthy and they might blindside me or betray me, I must be vigilant in protecting myself and those closest to me. And then us type nines, we might be thinking, well, since I shouldn't assert myself and my presence and voice don't really matter, I'm going to fixate solely on the desires and needs and wants of others to ensure that I can make them happy.
Now, John, one of the profound insights that you had that I found so helpful for myself is a negative or unhealthy soundtrack can't produce a healthy soundtrack. It almost, we find the same fear, the same result each time that we believe. One of the quotes that I wrote down was, broken soundtracks are one of the most persuasive forms of fear, because everything you listen to, one, it gets easier to believe in it the next time. Hmm. Why don't you talk about this, the cyclical ideas of how soundtracks actually work whenever we start walking down that path again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I often work with, say, an executive who's 42, and they're given a new opportunity at a big job to step into leadership, and they're pulling back, or even worse, they're self-sabotaging. And if you pull the thread, because I think it's always healthy to ask the thought behind the thought behind the thought, you often find that at 15, at 16, at 18, at 21, somebody in authority, a teacher, a parent, a professor said, you're not a natural leader. And they didn't know they were going to start listening to that at 17. But by the time I interact with them, they've listened to that song, that soundtrack, for 20 years. So now even just the hint of a leadership opportunity, even if they're qualified, even if everybody around them sees that ability, fires off that soundtrack because they've listened to it so often. It's kind of like if you listen to your favorite song for 20 years in a row, you know every lyric of, you know, the Journey song. You know every lyric of this. And so they get easier and easier and easier for you to believe, and they fire off in more and more situations where it might have been tied to one type of situation, but you start believing it in other situations too. And so that's that persuasive where, and then the other thing is I sometimes will say, the most persuasive person you've ever met is yourself. Like every bad decision I've ever made is because I first talked myself into it. Like, so when somebody says the only one standing in your way is you, I go, I know that guy is amazing. He's so good at convincing me to make, you know, and so I think that's part of it too. And I, you know, one of the things I say is that we tend to believe our thoughts are true because they're delivered in the voice we're most familiar with, our own. Every thought you have is delivered in your voice, and it's the voice you've heard more than any other in your life. So we tend to go, well, that must be true, even when your thoughts haven't been accurate. Because we've all had an experience where your thoughts said, that person's mad at you, they're so disappointed, that thing you said at the party, they're still thinking about it. You go and spend time with a person, they have no idea what you're talking about. They're not mad at all. And you never go back to your thought and go, hey, you got me this time. You were kind of wrong. So next time I'm not going to trust you as quick as I did this time. We never go back and correct the thought. So we just continue to push that forward because we don't take the time to go, wait a second, I don't think all my thoughts are true. What do I do with that? And I think that's a really healthy exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we actually, in our book, Becoming Us, the first chapter, it talks about how we assume incorrectly other people's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And we actually put a word to it called assumicide, because we assume and it actually hurts and destroys relationships. And I would say from an Enneagram perspective, we do that from our own Enneagram viewpoint, right? So, you know, for me, I might be thinking people are upset with me, disappointed with me because I didn't make them happy. Whereas it could be a type 8 that I'm talking to and they're just glad I said it outright, you know, and I was assertive, but I'm in scared because, oh no, like I actually said it and now they're probably mad at me because I didn't give in to their wishes. And like, no, I'm assuming incorrectly and it's hurting that relationship and I'm playing my own soundtrack versus taking a step out of my own way of thinking and trying to picture what would that person actually, how would it land on them in a different way?
Well, and I think that's important. Even my, I love that word, assumicide. I think that's so great. But for me, like the 3-7, if I have a failure and I just go, oh my gosh, this is such a terrible failure. And then I tell that to a 7, the 7 might go, what are you talking about? Like we learned so much. We had fun. Like life is messy. Yes. And I'm going, they're going to be so furious. Like this was the end of the world. Yes. This is such a big deal. And they've interpreted it differently. So I think that's another one of the things I do like about the Enneagram is that it gives you that pause to go, okay, but wait, how, you know, my wife's a 5. How is she going to interpret this differently than I am as a 3? How is she going to see this? And I think that's really healthy.
Yeah.
I'll have to be honest. This is just a cursory observation. I don't know if I've ever heard of a 3-5 couple type. Do we
really? We're the first?
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
So, John, we with our marriage platform, we had created a course for all 45 couple types. And
which can be found at becomingus.com.
Oh, gosh, that wasn't intended to be a pitch.
hey, babies need shoes. You guys, you're in a new fancy house.
People are going to be like, wait, you have a course for our couple type? And so I just told them where to get it.
But it is interesting to think. So now whenever we think about that course, you're going to be the image in our mind, you and Jenny.
Yeah.
3 and 5. First one.
What's the most prone to divorce? Hit me up.
We don't have the statistics on that, but most people say, well, what is the best or worst combination? And we're not just trying to like sweep over this, but it's truly the healthiest of types are the greatest couple type combinations. Yeah. And honestly, the worst, like the unhealthiest are the worst. Yeah. So it really, because, you know, we've seen couple types that are 2-8s and they're doing fantastic. And we've seen 2-9s and they're both catatonic.
Powerful, but yeah. Right.
But you think, oh, 2-9s, they're so like accommodating to each other. Well, if they're both unhealthy and catatonic,
it doesn't matter.
They're not going to be a great couple. So, and that's really true. But we could, if you want, we could say the 3 and the 5 couple type are the winners.
I think number one. I was trying to go for.
Yes. There we go.
I'm glad you saw that through that. Yes. As a 9, you were able to see what I needed.
I made you happy. Yes. Awesome.
That's great. Well, where I'd like to spend the rest of our time together is talking through these three words about, okay, mm-hmm. we all are overthinking. We've got certain pattern soundtracks. You know, one thing I was thinking of too is the core weakness for each Enneagram type, this unhealthy belief or behavioral way of that we bring to all of our relationships. Mm-hmm. That it comes out of certain beliefs that we have.
Yeah.
And there's a core weakness for each Enneagram type. But use three words, and then we'll just break them down on how we actually do this. So you talked about at the end of chapter one, retiring your broken soundtracks, replacing them with new ones, and repeat them until they're as automatic as the old ones. So I thought it, we'd just break it down, because as you break it down through the book, it becomes incredibly helpful. So, and it's surprising, too, that it's not just replace a thought in super easy terms. They're involving the totality of your humanity. So let's talk about one, retiring your broken soundtracks. And the first thing that came to mind in just working with people is, you know, how do you even identify that there's a broken soundtrack?
Oh, it's the easiest thing in the world. I can answer this. It is. So if every listener wants to do a 30-second activity, I can automatically help them identify a broken soundtrack. All you do is you write down a goal. So you write down a desire, a hope, a dream. So you write down, I want to start a podcast. I want to lose 10 pounds. I want to write a book. I want to move to Colorado. I want to date my spouse, whatever. Write it down and then listen to your first thoughts. Listen to the thoughts that follow that goal. Listen to your reaction, because every reaction is an education. It's educating you about what your thoughts are saying. So if your thoughts are, you should do that. Like, Jeff, you're the most qualified for that. You're going to do, it's finally time. We've been waiting for you to do that. People are going to love that. Amazing. Those are positive soundtracks. If though they're, who are you to do that? You think that'll work this time? It hasn't worked 10 times before. You're not equipped to do that. You can't do that. It's a negative soundtrack. And fear is funny. I always say fear argues both sides of the coin, because when you're in your 20s and 30s, fear will say you're too young. You're not wise enough. You don't have the maturity. Nobody will listen to you. Nobody will follow you. But then you hit your 40s, 50s, and 60s, and fear goes, it's too late. You missed your shot. Like, you're too old. And you want to say to fear, when I was at the perfect age to do this, as if fear will go, there were 10 minutes when you were 32. It was a Tuesday in October. It would have been amazing. So that's the easiest, fastest way to discover, do I have broken soundtracks? To name a change you want to make in your life, and then listen to your thoughts.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, though, is that now in our Enneagram experience in coaching people, some people will write out that goal and have a positive response to it. Mm-hmm. This is achievable. We can do this. And it's an assumption that it is positive. But some of those, what types might look at a goal but be unrealistic about the goal that it comes out positive?
Well, the sevens, for sure. And the eights, I think the threes, but they would be a little bit more measured. They'd be positive and optimistic about it, but they're not going to reach too lofty. Mm-hmm. Because
don't you think a four, like a four, definitely, right?
Yeah. Four could. Yeah. It depends on, because they're very idealistic of they. It's like they know what real beauty or the ideal version of something could be. Mm-hmm. And so if they're thinking that it's obtainable, they will be positive about it. But if they think it's unattainable, which could go either way, depending on what it is, they might then get more pessimistic about it.
They could think they can serve and take care of everybody. But this is, John, this is one of the other insights of the book, is that you actually give three questions that evaluate each of these beliefs, these soundtracks.
Yeah,
one, is it true? Is it helpful? And is it kind? Mm-hmm. Why don't you elaborate more? Because then this applies for each Enneagram type, just taking any belief or thought pattern that comes up of asking yourself these three questions.
Yeah,
that was, somebody asked me, what was the biggest surprise for me writing the book? The surprise was how many of my thoughts weren't true, helpful, or kind, and how many of my sentences had "you idiot" as the punctuation. And I cleaned that up for you guys, because there's Jesus is on the podcast. But so the questions are what I call Trojan horse questions. They're simple. They're obvious words. We're all familiar with these words. But if you'll sit with them, you'll learn something real about yourself. First question, is it true? Is the story I'm telling myself about myself true? Is the story I'm telling myself about this situation, this opportunity, this failure, this win, is it true? One of the greatest mistakes you can make is assuming all your thoughts are true. Second question, is it helpful? When I think this again and again and again, does it move me forward or does it pull me back? Now, why do we have to ask more than one question? Because there's some things in life that are true, but they're not helpful. I'll give you an example. So we wrote a teen version of soundtracks called Your New Playlist because so many parents came out of the woodwork and said, if I could have known how to choose and change my thoughts as a teenager, would have changed my whole life. So my two teenage daughters wrote a teen version. And one of the stories is about my youngest daughter failing a biology test. She bombed a biology test and a month later had another test. And that night before the test, she was telling herself, remember, you failed the last one. You failed the last one. You could fail this one. You failed the last one. Is it true she failed the last one? It is. It's 100% true. Is it helpful the night before the test to tell herself that 100 times before the next test? Of course not. And we said, if a friend texted you 100 times the night before a test and said, just wanted to remind you, you failed the last one. Just wanted to remind you, feel like that wouldn't be a friend. That'd be a monster. So some things in life are true, but they're not helpful. Every employee I talk to right now says it's so hard to hire people. It's impossible to hire people. Impossible to hire people. That's true. It's not helpful to have that soundtrack in your company culture. Third question, is it kind? Would I say it to a friend? If I said it to a friend, would they still want to be my friend? And there's this big study from Google about psychological safety and the value of psychological safety. So there's all this real science behind kindness that's just kind of entering the marketplace. And so those are the questions. And I always tell people, if you can't say yes to, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? It's probably a broken soundtrack that you need to retire because it's not something you're meant to be listening to.
It is interesting. That does remind me. I had done some training with Dan Allender, and one of the dynamics that he talks about, our concepts, is other-centered contempt and self-contempt. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that I have contempt for myself that eventually may have the dynamic of having contempt for others because mm-hmm. I assume they believe the same things about me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm literally projecting the belief on other people. But I love the idea of what would it look like for us to be kind to ourselves? Mm. Who was it? Who's the Nashville guy that wrote the song about being kind to ourselves? Was that an Andrew Peterson song?
It sounds like that could be in his wheelhouse. I don't
know. Oh, maybe. Man. Yeah.
But I think there's an epidemic of self-loathing right now for a number of reasons. Like there's a lot of people in the productivity space where it's about conquering yourself and like, you've got to conquer the bad parts of yourself. You've got to kind of beat this monster down versus going, I wonder what gifts I have. I wonder what would happen if I remove some of the chains from this ability I have versus I've got to stay one step ahead of myself. And productivity can get really unhealthy when it becomes about trying to conquer yourself and trying to detach from the things you desire and all these things that ultimately end in self-loathing if you're not careful.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, just retire broken soundtracks, identify them, just write down a goal, see what comes up, and then evaluate those responses that you have internally by three questions. Is it true? Is it helpful? And is it kind?
Well, and the other thing is just have self-awareness. Self-awareness is just overhearing yourself. So when you're in a situation, a situation comes to mind. We're at somebody's 25th wedding anniversary, and there was probably 20 of us in this little small living room. And the mother of this couple had put together this amazing letter, and she was reading it. And I felt so uncomfortable. Like I felt like, oh, say something sarcastic, ruin this whole moment. I had the wherewithal to go, I don't think that's helpful, dude. I don't think that's going to be helpful to this. Like, and I think I need to workshop a little bit why real honest emotional moments make me want to detonate them with sarcasm. Yeah. Like we should probably do some work on that question. So I think having some self-awareness, overhearing yourself in situations can be really valuable when it comes to how do I retire?
Yeah. Well, and when we look at the Enneagram, and it kind of went with the soundtracks that I listed earlier, is that there's what we call at your Enneagram coach, the interpreted childhood message. And these are the false messages that really are the soundtracks in our mind. Now, a lot of times we'll say, oh, well, that's because a parent or a teacher said it. It's like, no, they're literally like your soundtracks. And either they were directly said or you interpreted circumstances based off of that already ingrained soundtrack. So the type one is it's not okay to make mistakes. The type two is it's not okay to have your own needs. Type three is it's not okay to have my own identity or my emotions. Type four is that it's not okay to be too much or not enough. The type five is it's not okay to be too comfortable in the world. Type 6 is it's not okay to trust myself. Type 7 is it's not okay to depend on anyone for anything. Mm-hmm. Type 8, it's not okay to trust anyone. And type 9, it's not okay to assert yourself. And so...
You're like a fun party game. Like you just... Yeah, take a scenario and then you just walk the wheel with the Enneagram.
Yeah, you really rattled that off. That was great. That was fantastic.
It is weird. It's not for everything, right? I don't have all those things for everything else in the world, but maybe the Enneagram.
Enough. You've got enough.
But I think what's important is a lot of times people will sit around and maybe blame a person or circumstance or situation and because in their mind, see that person said or did this, and it may not have been their intentions. So for me, you know, my thought, it's not okay to assert yourself, comes from a very specific story of mine as a child that this person was embarrassed that I had done something that actually was, you know, a pretty good idea for a five-year-old, but it was embarrassing to them. And they, you know, said, hey, we can't do that. And so
I love how you're telling the story right now.
Yeah,
you're protecting her.
Yeah. But as a five-year-old, my first thought was I should never have asserted myself. I thought it was a great idea, but never will I do that again because I upset that person. And
that is a battle to this day.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, that's why it took me until I was 40 to start your Enneagram coach. Because I thought that person was giving me the message, don't assert yourself. That is not what the person was trying to say at all. That would crush them if they thought.
They certainly weren't saying for the next 35 years, I need you.
Right. At least, yeah.
Maybe, this is now maybe, a law. This is a law for you.
Right. I need you.
Like, yeah.
But it goes to, and the reason why I brought that up is because like for you as a type three, the point of you wanting to have some sarcasm in that moment. Well, the three, it's like, I can't have my own identity or authentic emotions. And so like in this moment, there's these authentic emotions that feel awkward and weird. And like, and so the seven part of you is like, hey, let's bring some fun in here. Let's like, you know, do something different because that's so hard. But is it true? It's not true. I can assert myself. I do have a presence and a voice and gifts and talents that I can assert my, you know, presence in the world. And so we have to, like you were saying, retire those faults. We have to first know what they are.
Yeah.
Then we have to retire and then replace them. So now I have to replace on a daily basis. This is important. This isn't just like a one and done. I wish it was. Mm. But on a daily basis, I am fighting as a type nine that my presence doesn't matter, that I shouldn't assert myself. And on a daily basis, I have to remember how God created me and what he has called me to do and to show up. And to show up in the way that honors him and that blesses others. And that is so, so hard. I almost have to like envision myself behind myself, giving myself a little push.
Well, I've nicknamed the seven part of my heart El McCordo. It was a nickname that guys in a men's Bible study that I was leading call it. Because when things would get intense, intimate, or really transparent and vulnerable, El McCordo would just drop some bomb.
Provocative bomb
and just totally kill the moment. But they called me El McCordo then. Well, hey, so we've talked about identifying and retiring. Now let's talk about replacing them with a new soundtrack. Mm. So tell us about what does it look like to begin replacing some of these beliefs?
Well, I mean, you're right. It is an activity. It's a daily activity. And your brain is waiting to be told what to think. Like we talk about thoughts as if they're outside of us. We say she got carried away by her thoughts. He got lost in his thoughts. We've never been taught how to think. You know, even though, you know, you mentioned God and his role in this, like we're told throughout scripture, take every thought captive. Think on what's true, what's noble, what's beautiful. If you read the Bible, thought is all through there and the value of how your thoughts are deliberate. But we have a really hard time going, oh, wait, you're saying I have permission to think a certain way and there's a process to think a certain way. So that's what you do with replace is you go, okay, if I retire these thoughts, what are the thoughts I want to have instead? And how do I make sure that I actually start to believe them? And so for me, I'll just pull something off my wall. Here's a thought that I decided I wanted to have. It says, ask for more. I wrote it on August 27th, 2020, because I found myself undervaluing my work. in negotiations in this chair when I do Zoom meetings, Microsoft Teams, whatever. So I didn't come up with a complicated, that's not creative. You couldn't hear this and go, well, not everybody's a writer. We couldn't have figured out the words ask for more. But I just needed a reminder of the truth is my work has value. And that's a shortcut to remembering that. And so I put that on my wall. And then that kind of bleeds into the repeat. Like I see that every, you know, hundreds of times a day. And it's been up there for going on 2.5 years. And so that's a lot of it is to go, okay, what are the thoughts I want instead? And I always tell people, start with other things that inspire you. I would never say to somebody, just sit down with a blank piece of paper and then go, what do I want to think? Like, that's so overwhelming. I never sit down with a blank piece of paper to write my books. Like, I always bring other thoughts. So I think it's a healthy exercise to go, what are soundtracks I hear that are inspiring to me or motivating to me? I have another one on the wall that says Light and Easy. And I wrote that because when I was starting to write this book, I decided one of my thoughts for this book is going to be it's light and easy because that's what I'm promised by Jesus. Jesus promised me that my burden is going to be light and easy. I feel a burden for this book. I'm going to think about that, repeat that, replace that over and over and over versus writers tend to go, going to the coal mine, like one of the famous things about writing is you open a vein and you bleed on the page. Oh my gosh, like get over yourself. So like, I was like, no. This book's going to be light and easy. It's going to be challenging. I'm going to put hard work into it, all of that. But I'm going to like, before I even start the project, can I imagine what a really fun book would be like? Oh man, that'd be light and easy. So then you start to dream and you go, okay, my marriage, what would be a soundtrack that I'd replace? Like, oh, laughter, like we laugh together can be a soundtrack and you write that down. So you start to kind of open up this world of thought possibility and you start to go, and again, it feels foreign at first because nobody in ninth grade has a class that says, here's how to do mindset. Like that's my goal with the Your New Playlist book is that I think teenagers should be taught mindset in the same way they're taught finances. 20 years ago, we were like, hey, here's a credit card. Good luck. Try not to wreck your life. We'll see you when you're 30 and Sally Mae owns everything. And now we go, what if in eighth grade we taught them how to balance a checkbook or how to not go into debt? I think the same is true of thought, but that's what I mean by replace is that you have this fun activity.
You know, Bethy, and John writes about this in the book, but I think it's been something that we've even practiced in our marriage. Like there are times whenever we've really been caught up and gotten into a shame cycle. And the only thoughts that we have that are filling our mind are some of these negative beliefs that we have about ourselves. We'll actually say to one another, hey, I'm going to suggest that you borrow my perspective of who you are, where we'll actually just pronounce beliefs, gifts, whatever they may be about the other person. And when I can't believe it about myself, maybe I'll believe you for this moment.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is that in our new book, More Than Your Number, really, this is kind of what we're going through. So we talk about wounded child and beloved child. So our wounded child has these false messages. And so in the back of the book, we break down each of the 9 types into bite-sized, like bullet points, cheat sheets. Mm-hmm. And we literally show you, like, I think it's 3 to 5 false messages that are going to, like, soundtracks that are going to run through your mind. And, but then what does the beloved child of your heart, the one that's redeemed, what is the truth messages that it can impart to that wounded child? So what are the things that we can replace that actually are specific to your Enneagram type? And I think that that is so important because the messages that John is going to struggle with or you're going to struggle with is not the same ones that I'm going to struggle with. Now, it's great to know what you guys are struggling with so I can come alongside you and support you. But to do my own internal work, I need to know. And especially us 9, sometimes we have that fog. So it's like, I don't know. What am I thinking? So this is a cheat sheet. You guys can see what some of your core false messages, soundtracks are, and then what to replace it with. And one other point is to go with how David did this in Psalms 42. You know, mm-hmm. He said, why are you downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in God. So he's seen there's something mm-hmm. going on inside him that he wants to retire and replace it with the hope that is actually true.
Now, John, if you could give me a little space to be curious here, I'm a little surprised, but not really, but that a type 3 writes on a card, ask for more. The stereotype is 3s know they're worth it because they're awesome at everything.
They're confident.
And they're confident in everything that they do. But underneath all of that shiny veneer is you're worth more.
Yeah.
Tell me about what, I mean, what, where does that come from for you?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is I grew up in the church, and the church doesn't have a healthy relationship with success or performance or right. money or, you know, like a million things. I mean, in Nashville, I had a musician tell me, if you buy a $75,000 Suburban, Christians go, good for you. That's a family car. You can get a lot of kids in there. If you buy a $75,000 BMW, they say Jesus could have used that money. So I think part of it is my own brokenness with sure. success, like, and yes. ignoring the parable where it's like, here's five talents. They immediately go to work. They don't go, we're going to fast for 7 days. They immediately put it to work. They double it and there's a party. So I think part of it is some of my own broken yeah. soundtracks around, okay, like you should not be as successful. You should know, you know, like you yeah. should only use your talents to be a missionary. Like if you're not a missionary, it shouldn't like, so I think there's some of it's related to that is my yeah. own personal mm-hmm. broken soundtracks about what it means to be a successful Christian.
Mm. Well, thanks for sharing that. Cause it, there are so many stereotypes that we mm-hmm. carry with numbers, but we fail to recognize the unique experience of each person and the messages behind some of the stereotypes. And so we're really appreciative of that. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Cause it,
oh yeah.
Even in, there's a recovery meeting that I attend, and we even have a phrase in the readings. It says, we will become more comfortable with failure and success. And I'm like, I'm just trying to get over failure. You mean I'm gonna have to get comfortable with success too?
Oh, I yes. think success. I mean, look at everyone who falls that's successful. There's no, like, success is right. by no means an elixir to a better life. Like it's, yeah. I think there's arguments that success is as hard to handle as failure.
Mm. Yes. Well, so the last question is, how can we repeat? So there's three things: retire, replace, and repeat. How can we repeat a new soundtrack in order for it to become an as automatic as a new one? Mm. Now, for me, John, I wrote these. I've had French doors on my office, both in our last home and our new home now. And I don't remember exactly when, but I had them written, these little reminders of this over that. So that is my tendency, and I'm choosing this. As I walk into my office, I wrote it on every pane of the French door. And then somebody wiped them clean. And I've just not put them back. But
was it Jesus? Jesus went to was it Jesus? Was it the blood of the lamb? What was it?
That's so funny. Who did that?
Huh? I think, yeah. But but that was a way for me to kind of repeat the new soundtrack. It was as if I'm going into a place, like rather than bringing these negative beliefs with me into my office, I'm actually going to enter in with these thoughts right in front of me. Mm. What are your suggestions about how we can repeat these new soundtracks?
Well, when it comes to repeat, that's a great example. Me having a note card on my wall is an example. The reason you need to repeat, I had so many people 48 hours after the book came out say, hey, I retired, I replaced, and it's just not working. And I would say, well, the book's only existed for 48 hours, so I know you haven't had time to actually do it. And one of the things I'll say, like, with health goals, you see people go, the exercise plan is not working. I'll say, well, how long have you done? They'll say, 10 days. And I go, how long did it take you to gain the weight? They'll say 10 years. You gave the problem 10 years to develop and the solution only 10 days. It's so unkind to yourself. Never give the problem a year and the solution a week. And so that's the art of the repeat, is going, it's going to take some time. There are times when a single soundtrack can change in a single moment, but a lot of times it's been there for a long time. So, you know, I love the power of a symbol. Like you writing on the wall was a symbol. I always encourage people, find a symbol, and there's three things every good symbol needs. It needs to be personal. It needs to be connected to you. It needs to be visible. You need to be able to see it. It's not stuck in a drawer. And it needs to be simple, simple enough that it's not complicated. I'll show you one of mine. I had a book due, and you've written millions of books. I think you're writing a book right now probably because you're very busy. But there's a lot of pressure when you're going to turn in a book. There's a lot of pressure there. And I had a family vacation coming right before a book was due. And I knew that in other times, on those moments, I'd been physically present, but mentally absent. So I wrote a note on my wall that said, don't miss it. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. And then we went to Jackson Hole, and I was present enough in that moment to notice, wow, the pine cones they have here are different than the pine cones I have in Nashville. They look so different. So I just picked up a pine cone in Jackson Hole, and I brought it back 1,800 miles or whatever the distance is. And now it's on my desk because I know I'm going to be tempted to miss something else. In the busyness of life, I'll be tempted. So this is now a symbol to me. And it makes sense to me. For somebody else, it might not mean anything, but it's personal to me. My favorite example of those three things is the Nike Livestrong bracelet, which was against cancer. Like when you met people that had them, they never said, oh, I don't know anybody that's had cancer. I just hate disease. I have an eczema necklace I wear. I wear jewelry about diseases. They always said, my uncle, my aunt, my mother had breast cancer. Second, it was visible. Nike could have made it flesh colored. They could have made it gray. They didn't. They made it bright yellow on purpose. And the third, it was simple to use. No one was confused by how a bracelet works. Nobody was like, so the arm goes in the hole part? Like I had no idea. This is my first bracelet. This is crazy. So I think a symbol can be really powerful. And what happens is often when you read that chapter, you notice you already have a bunch. Like you go, wow, these things on my fridge are symbols. The thing on my nightstand is a symbol. The things on my shelves in my office are a symbol. So I think often tying a soundtrack, a thought to a physical symbol is a great way to learn how to repeat it again and again and again.
Well, Beth, I mean, you've done that with your elephant pictures in mm-hmm. your bedroom.
Yeah. So when I have an elephant picture also where one of my places that I work. Mm-hmm. and it's just a reminder of the one that I actually probably love the most is the one that our director of coaching, Adam Breckenridge, and his wife, Carrie, gave to me. And it's an elephant with the herd behind her, so the matriarch. Mm-hmm. And just to remind me that my presence matters as the leader of your Enneagram coach, that
That's right.
to show up matters, to not hide, to not think less of. But to also be in community with one another. And so, yeah, whenever I look at that, one, it's endearing because, you know, it's given to me out of love and affection. And so it reminds me of that. But it also reminds me, no, get out there, do it. Like, this mm-hmm. is important. So, yeah, I think symbols, pictures, notes, like you have on your wall and the note cards, all of those things can matter. I even have a little figurine that means a lot to me about something else. So, yeah, I think anything can mm-hmm. really shift your mind.
One last meaty topic I'd like to address here to close is that with some of these reminders, there's also just the lingering belief itself and all of the sacrifices or things that we've missed out on because we've sabotaged and walked away from. And it's the idea of shame. You actually address shame in the book a little bit. And so like there you are, Bethy, you've had some significant meetings on our back patio and you probably don't feel like the matriarch. You don't feel like, but you're looking at this image reminding you that you are, and there's a temptation, an opportunity to walk down, see this, actually this token to remind me of a healthy belief is a reminder of what I don't believe. I'll never get there.
Yeah.
John, how do you handle when it comes up with shame, that these are messages that we believe for a long time, we see the damage that it's done, and as we're striving for these other ones, and still shame finds its way to sneak back up.
Well, I don't beat myself up for shame. I don't say I failed because shame arrived. I wouldn't say I push back when people say you can become fearless. And the reason I push back by that is I think at any time you do new things at new levels, there's an element of fear. I think the only way to be fearless is to never try anything new. The only way to have shame is to never have any feeling. I think shame, like there's going to be some shame involved. So the thing I often say, well, fear or shame is it gets a voice, not a vote. I'm going to listen. I'm going to learn. I'm going to process with maybe my counselor, Chip Dodd, maybe my wife, maybe a group of men that I love, whatever. It has a voice, but it doesn't get a vote in the sense that it sits at the head of the table or the back porch for Beth's example and says, no, you don't get to be assertive. Like you don't get to do that. So I always am, you know, in the process of going, okay, how do I do that? And then something that David Thomas, who's one of the counselors at Daystar, amazing organization in Nashville, taught me, is that when it comes to shame or negative thoughts or stress or anything we judge as negative, most people want there to be a switch. They want to find one thing that'll turn it off forever. And so they try yoga and they go, I did it. And then a week later, the stress comes back. Or they go, I found an Enneagram and Enneagram will solve all my problems. I'll never have to do work again. I'll never feel stressed or shame. And then like 2 weeks later, they go, oh my gosh. So he said, it's much better to think of life as a dial, not a switch. And when a dial gets loud and your shame dial gets turned up to 10 or 11 or 12, you have turn down techniques that help you turn down the shame, turn down the fear. And so my approach with that is less of a surprise. I'm not going to be surprised by it and feel, it's funny, we have feelings about feelings and sometimes we feel shame about shame. And so I'm not going to feel that. I'm going to go, oh, there it is again. What are the things I do to turn it down? What are the healthy things in response? Looking at that, you guys telling each other, hey, I need you to borrow my perspective about you. That's such a great shame killer or shame dissolver, however you want to say it. And so if I can have turn down techniques, then I know when shame gets to 11, when fear gets to 11, when stress gets to 11, because life is stressful. There's shame in my past. There's going to be shame in my future. I'm not going to make all the right decisions from now, even though I've gone to counseling. So I can turn it down like a dial.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I love that section in the book. There's a great phrase that you use. The antidote to overthinking isn't more thinking. The antidote is action. And actually, our shame, our fear moves us. I mean, this straight from Voice of the Heart. You mentioned Chip Dodd, who's been also a gift for Beth and I and our family as we...
God, he's the best, dude. He's such a guru, dude. There's very few people I would say a guru status.
Yeah.
Chip Dodd is a guru.
Yes, but it moves you to action, and that not only is just there are thinking things that you can do, there are physical things you can do, you can engage in new ways. But remember that shame and fear they're to be welcomed, and invitations to something else.
Right,
and they don't have to be avoided. Although that's our natural inclination, they actually become opportunities.
Well, that goes back to like beating yourself up about, or like conquering yourself. I'm much more in a space where I go, okay, you know, and I've heard Jerry Carbona say like the wounded soldier who thinks he's protecting you, but he isn't, or the loyal soldier that you go, I'm not going to come up with stronger defenses to fight that part of myself. I'm going to welcome it in for coffee and go, hey, you started fighting for me when I was 14 and I didn't have all these tools and this ability. I don't need you on the wall the same way I used to need on the wall. Thank you for your service. I need you to stop shooting everybody. Like you only know one thing, it's to shoot. So I need you to come in here and let's have a conversation. Thank you for your service. I need you to retire because I don't need you anymore. And that to me feels like a much healthier approach than I just got to come up with enough techniques to keep these five parts of myself locked in a closet.
Yep. Absolutely.
Well, John, thank you so much for spending some time with us. You've got something that's launching this week, and it's a new challenge. Tell us a little bit about it and tell everybody where they need to go.
Yeah, I'm a huge goal nerd. It's my favorite thing in the world to talk about goals, obviously. So I have something called the Guaranteed Goals Challenge. It's 3 days where we're going to work on goals because it's January, and it's just acuff.me/challenge. And we'll have 19,000 people in the Facebook group. So it's also another chance to go, you're not meant to dream alone. We talked about community a number of different ways throughout this. Everyone on 1 through 9 needs community in a different way. And so it's a really fun community. It's 100% free. And it's my chance to do essentially 3 keynotes from my own house and help a lot of people dream the right way, the best way, the healthiest way for the rest of the year.
Oh, that's great.
Awesome. That's at acuff.me/challenge, right?
Exactly. acuff.me/challenge. And I have a podcast. I'll have to have you guys on at some point called All It Takes Is a Goal, which is about, guess what? It's about goals.
That's awesome.
That's great. Hey, well, if you're interested in learning more about your own Enneagram type as it relates to defeating beliefs and unhealthy patterns, be sure to head on over to myenneagramcoach.com. That's where you can find one of our 2,000 plus certified coaches in over 30 different countries that are ready and prepared to help you apply some of these ideas to your own life. So Bethy, why don't you go ahead and close us out?
Yeah, well, thanks guys for joining us today. And remember that the Enneagram reveals your need for Jesus, not your need to work harder, because it's the